Welcome to the Assembling Inclusion Podcast. On this show, we feature different programs, individuals, and initiatives focused on being more inclusive of individual needs. We invite you to learn right alongside us. If you want some additional resources or access to our courses, please visit our website or follow us on social media. But for right now, let's get right to the episode. Today, we're talking about an organization that has been around for 30 years this year called Do It, which is based out of the University of Washington. There are so many different components and pieces of this program, from supporting students and families to educating higher education faculty and professionals to training on universal design and accessibility. We talked to Cheryl Bergstaller, who founded Do It, about the work that has been done, the various opportunities that exist, and the longstanding impact of the program. So let's take a listen. Welcome back to the Assembly Inclusion Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about Do It, based out of the University of Washington. Do It is an acronym that stands for Disability, Opportunities, Internetworking, and Technology. We're going to be talking to Cheryl Bergstaller, who is the founder and the director of Do It. So Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.
So I saw that Do It recently celebrated 30 years, which is pretty incredible. That's been around for a really long time. Would you mind explaining the mission and the inspiration behind starting this organization?
My academic background is in math and computer science, but also I have a teaching degree. And so I taught middle school and high school and at the college level, and very much like teaching and interacting with teenagers. So Do It focuses on helping young people with disabilities in high school transition to college and careers. I'd like working with that age group, and so much can happen during that period of time for any student, but for students with disabilities, a number of other issues that other students might not face. But my background in disability goes way back to a personal experience. Several of them, actually. My first husband was paraplegic, but the paraplegia was caused from radiation treatments due to cancer, and he eventually died of cancer, but he spent the last few years of his life in a wheelchair. And we went from me being a cheerleader and him being a football player as very young people in our late teens, dealing with disability, but also terminal illness at the same time. There's certainly a lot of tragedy to that, but also a lot that I learned about how people with disabilities are treated in the world. I was always in tune to that. And then I ran into a young man who was quadriplegic, 6 years old he was, trying to get into first grade. He was in special ed, but couldn't use his hands. And so they didn't think he could participate in elementary school in the regular classroom. So I helped him learn how to use a computer a long time ago now. It was an old Apple II computer. So he could prove to the school that he could participate in a classroom. And he was then mainstreamed and included in that environment. Fast forward, I ended up at the University of Washington, and I was directing the accessible technology services as well as desktop computing services at the university. I was already involved in making technology accessible to people with disabilities, but I wanted to do a little bit more. And I looked around campus and found that a lot of people that are living their passion get their own money. And so I set about learning from the experts and some experimentation on my own on how to write and receive grants. Do It emerged from that in 1992 with an initial grant from the National Science Foundation. The whole purpose of the Do It Center, which it is today, that grew from that one grant, is to increase the success of people with disabilities, but particularly as they transition to college and participate in college and then transition to careers. We tend to work with students that are like late high school, helping them transition to college. And if you look at the research, if you want to do that, or even personal experiences, a lot of the difficulties that students with disability face are those transition periods. Like they may have a really supportive high school or not actually with what they're doing, but then high school ends. And so then they get to college, but they have difficulties. They might end up dropping out of college, but there's no safety net there because it's not like a K-12 school system where somebody's there that's paying attention to you. So I saw that. I like working with teenagers and had personal interest as well, but decided to start this program. And getting into the Do It program, It's much like joining an extended family. We find places for students with disabilities that are participants in our program to continually participate. We have a Do It Scholars program, for instance, for high school students with disabilities, and they learn about college life, live in the dormitory and so forth, get access to computers. But then as they get older, they increasingly become mentors to the younger students that come into the Do It Scholars program. So they can stay and participate as long as they want. We have students in their 40s that started the program back in 1993 or around that time that are still participating in the program. They might help us give presentations, be on panels at conferences. They mentor the younger kids that come along, much like a family would. We had one student say, it's easier to get in to do it than it is to get out.
That's so nice, though. I didn't realize that people were still involved from the very beginning stages of the program. That's really amazing that they're still mentoring and supporting the new students who are coming through the program. That's really incredible that they're still heavily involved in the organization.
Yeah. We've had a few even marry each other.
Oh, that's so nice. It's like a love story. They met in the program. That's so sweet. I love that. So you had mentioned the Do It Scholars program, and I was reading in the big 30th anniversary announcement, the statistics from the program, and I had seen that over, I think it was 570 students have benefited from the program, which is like a tremendous amount of students. Could you speak specifically to that program and how you mentioned like the mentorship and how it works with students coming in and learning more about college, but could you talk a little bit more about that program?
The Do It Scholars program, students with disabilities can apply after their sophomore year or junior year in high school. So we want them to still be in high school at the time. It's a competitive program. It's quite expensive to run and they don't have to pay for it. So we can only take about 20 students per year in that particular program. Then once you're in that program, you will come for three consecutive summer programs. One, you kind of get oriented and you learn about college life. You live in a dormitory, you have a roommate, all those things. Students with disabilities in that program, they're all types of disabilities. So some of them are obvious, students who are deaf or students who are blind or using wheelchairs, but many of them are not. We have students who are on the autism spectrum, who have attention deficit issues, health impairments, and so forth. And that's by design, which is unusual for a program with students with disabilities. We want them to become leaders in the next generation or their generation. In order to be a leader in the disabled community, we think it's important that they learn about disabilities other than their own, so they can really get a handle on how do you make a more accessible, inclusive world, not just for them and their disability, but for other people with disabilities as well. I believe strongly that if you do that, then it's a lot more accessible, inclusive for everybody else. So they come to the summer program and they participate for a couple of weeks. And then the next year they come back. So we have this cohort sort of thing. And this new cohort will come in and they'll meet the new scholars. They'll also meet the ones that were the year ahead of them. And so it broadens their community and their connection to the program since they know more people in the program. The third year is an optional year where they are actually interns in the program. We don't pay them, but they get free room and board and they are workers and they learn how we run the program behind the scenes. Their job is just not to have fun themselves, but to make sure that the younger scholars have fun and learn what they're supposed to do in the program. And so that's an essential part of the program as well. But you can see we have these three consecutive years. And so we can build on that for this community to continue to engage online mainly after that.
That's really great that it's multiple years. That's really great for that community building. I love the fact that new people are coming in and they get to experience the people who came before them. That's a really nice reciprocal relationship. I like the fact that it's all mixed too, all different types of disabilities, because you're right. I haven't seen that often.
Yeah, that's not a real common thing. We, right from the beginning, we have to deal with that there's a level of discomfort in some cases that they often don't vocalize until the end of the program, actually. Students who have physical disabilities think, well, I didn't know about kids with learning disabilities, that we kind of embrace that awkwardness. That's okay. That's all right. We'll even have small groups where they're in the small group with students who have disabilities similar to their own, especially early on in the program. They helps develop that comfort level. But then most of the time, the disabilities are mixed and it gives them some experience too about what they can contribute. For example, if you're in an engineering lab, hands-on lab, and your lab partner is blind and you are quadriplegic and you're not provided with any accommodations, you can kind of figure out who's going to do what. We make sure that the combination of those two people have all the skills that they need to do that thing in that engineering lab. And then when they become interns, same thing. We might have two people that are in charge of the treats, getting the treats out and organizing them, getting them in there on time after a program is ending. But we make sure that between the two of them, they can organize the activity in such a way that they can do it well. And so a student can't just say, well, I can't see the treats. And so therefore it's kind of a mess. No. You've got your partner. You've got somebody who can see. Does that look okay? Is that an attractive display of candy and other treats for the program?
It's a nice collaboration then. That's really awesome that that's how it's structured.
It really focuses on them figuring out what they have to contribute, not focusing so much on what they can't do. We're not so interested in what they can't do. We're interested in what they can do. And that's what their future employer is going to be interested in as well.
I love that mindset. It's a shift to the positive, the strengths, the abilities, as opposed to something you feel like you can't do. I think that's a great mindset. What other opportunities do you have within DoIt that exist for students that are in high school or actively in college? Are there any other programs?
We have quite a few programs. And one is just the DoIt Pals program. And that's open to any student with a disability that's a teenager that's thinking about going to college. That program is fully online because it isn't expensive. And so you can join our electronic community and you will interact with the scholars and other students with disabilities. So you can get that part of it. In that electronic community, you also learn about internships that are available in the summer and all the other things that the DoIt Scholars hear about. You get that as well. So that's one option for students that don't go into the scholars program, but anybody else that hears about it. Then we have individual projects like Access Computing is one that we've had 5 separate grant proposals that were funded by the National Science Foundation. The Access Computing project is to increase the success and the participation of people with disabilities in computing and IT careers. Like many of our projects, we take a stakeholder model. We look at students with disabilities, that individual student as the hub on a wheel, if you can imagine it. And then around the edges on those spokes are the different stakeholders that can promote their success or erect barriers to their success. And we work with those stakeholder people in those roles. So Access Computing, again, we work with students who are interested in computing careers, high school students, college students. We publicize that program. So we have participants from all over the country because it's an online community. And so we can do that. They have mentors, but then we also work with other stakeholders. A big one is faculty members. So we work with IT and computing faculty members to help them include students with disabilities in their courses so that the environment will be more inclusive. What does that mean? Well, if they're using documents in a PDF format that's not designed for access for a blind student who uses a screen reader, we show them how to design that better, but give them tips for including students on the autism spectrum or students with other types of disabilities in their classes. But we don't stop there. We encourage computing and IT faculty members to include disability-related content in their courses. We feel that too many people in computer science and other fields are graduating with no knowledge about accessibility. And then they might show up at Microsoft or somewhere where they have an opportunity to make accessible products and they don't know how to do it. So we're really working closely with faculty to help them develop some skills and some ideas about how they can consider accessibility in their courses. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we work with mentors, we work with disability services offices to encourage students with disabilities to pursue computing and IT. We work with IT companies. So we work with Google and Amazon and Microsoft to help them increase the accessibility of the products that they produce. One example of that is we've worked a lot with Zoom to help them continue to make their product more accessible to presenters, but also attendees and meetings that are hosted by Zoom.
The program has such a wide reach. That was like my big takeaway from when I was looking into it initially. There are so many things that you're doing. I love the fact that you're educating the faculty to not only about the accessible curriculum, the accessible materials for their students, but then just disability overall, because you're right. I think there are a lot of people going into the world of computer science with knowledge of programming, which yes, you need to know how to program and code, but lacking that accessibility knowledge. If we had more programmers going out there knowing how to make accessible materials, it could be already incorporated into their design. So there was the Access Computing program, and there's a lot of different access programs. What do you think have been the most popular ones?
So much depends on what grant we're applying for, because almost all of those named projects are funded by a specific grant or multiple grants, like Access Computing is funded by five different sequential grants. We have partners, for instance, we're partnering with the Computer Science Department and the Information School on our own campus. And so that's one thing that's characteristic of all of our projects, is that we're just not trying to do it ourselves. We're trying to partner with the appropriate organization. So I'd say Access Computing might be considered the most popular one, but it's because it's been around so long. But we have a project called Access STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, Mathematics, that came from a sequence of projects funded by the National Science Foundation as well. And it's more broadly focused on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. But we do many of the things that we do in Access Computing. And then sometimes we actually will focus on a particular group within the disabled community. A good example of that is our NNL project, which is a neuroscience for neurodiverse learners. So we're working with neurodiverse learners, roughly defined as people that their disability kind of impacts the way they think through things. Students that are on the autism spectrum, students with certain types of learning disabilities, attention deficits, and so forth, are invited into that program, and they're learning about neuroscience. The goal is like Access STEM, and we want them to take interest in science, and that's what NSF cares about, but it's a little bit more of a monogamous group in that they have similar disabilities, which is okay too. We do a lot of different things, and it depends so much on what NSF says they want to fund, and they'll come up with a solicitation, and we then will respond to it, and in all cases, we have to make sure that we provide what they would like to do, NSF, and we fit our program in there. Often the ones we're competing with, other project proposals, are also into this broadening participation community, which is usually focused on women and racial ethnic minorities. And so we kind of get in there, and often they'll fund a bunch of grants under a certain category, and we're the only one that's focused on disability. But we always put in there too that we're very interested in supporting intersectionality. So if a student has a learning disability, but also is from a racial ethnic minority group or female or whatever, we pay attention to those other minoritized status that they might have that contributes to their experience.
That's a great point, that not only is it the disability focus, but you could have all those intersectionalities that go into play when somebody is applying into that program. So you could be supporting a wide variety of people Yes. that just happen to all have a classified disability, but then there's other factors at play, which is really Yeah. awesome.
And unfortunately, some of those programs don't deal with intersectionality back the other direction. We Yeah. work with, and this is another type of grant we get, Access Cyber Learning. Got two of those grants. And it was part of a collection of grants, hundreds of them, by the way, by now, that have been funded by the National Science Foundation to create the next generation of cyber learning technology. So basically, a digital technology that would be used for supporting learning. A lot of these projects are creating tools and games and so forth that can be used, for instance, by elementary students and maybe high school students to get them into STEM. We have had grants to help those projects make their technology that they're developing accessible to students with disabilities, because that often isn't the case. They don't think about it, I think, is the main thing. And other times they just think that it's going to be too complicated. We try to assure them that, first of all, you don't have to deal with everything all at once, particularly in a small grant, but at least give it some thought. Just pause and think, how could we make this game accessible to a student who's blind or one who is deaf or one with a mobility impairment? And even if they can't fully work on the accessibility piece, to at least acknowledge that in the articles that they publish, the research articles, which they all do, under a limitation of their study. You know, say this was a small pilot project and we didn't deal with accessibility, but that's something for future research.
Even just the consideration of just pausing to say, what are some barriers that could exist as I'm creating this? That would even be helpful just to get started. What might be an issue for somebody if they're trying to access this program, and then thinking about solutions for that. But that's impressive that there were so many grants that have been involved in this program so far.
It's nice to get them to open that door, and also to reassure them they don't have to have all the answers. I mean, in their future grants, maybe they'll think about including someone on their team that knows about accessibility. But a lot of these grants are very small, and they just might have a couple of research students working on the research. And so being a grant recipient myself, I know there are limitations, but they might, as you said, just at least reflect on it. Reflect on that as a limitation of their study. There are many other limitations they have, but the main one is how much money they get and how much time they can spend on it. So just put that on your list, at least.
So I did want to ask you, you had mentioned when you talked about some of the programs that they're online, so you have the online community, so it's not as financially restrictive and is open to more people because people can just go online and network and have informal mentorship that way.
I also noticed that you have a lot of communities of practice specifically for educators through DoIt. I was wondering, how do those communities typically function?
Many of our projects will have a community of practice. And that's different, as you said, that's different from the student part of this, which we'll often call the Access Computing team, or the STEM team. I like using that team. Okay. Tell the students they're in this together. But we like the other stakeholder groups in our stakeholder model to have an option to engage as well. I'll just give an example of one project we're working on right now. It's called Access Advance. And Advance is a program within National Science Foundation to increase the participation of women faculty in the STEM fields. So these are post-secondary professors in STEM. They want to increase the number of women in those fields, and we have a long way to go, frankly. Our project, not surprisingly, Access Advance, is we're working to increase the participation of women faculty members who have disabilities. And so we have a community of practice there, and the community of practice is very open. If you go to our website and look at communities of practice, you'll see quite a number of them, and Access Advance would be one. So it's open to people who are participating in that project, but also anybody else that learns about it that wants to talk about the issues surrounding barriers and solutions within STEM fields for women who have disabilities. And many times what comes of that community, besides the engagement, is they might be targeted then for a future grant in that area. So we now have this group of people that have been with us for a few years and say, hey, we're going to write a grant on such and such. Do you want to partner with us in that? So that's part of it. We keep that community going. We do it in such a way too, that if we didn't get future funding, the community doesn't have to die. The community's there. And our future projects might be doing things like we'll send out to the communities we have information about grants that are coming up they might want to apply for, or programs like a webinar they might want to go to that we're sponsoring as part of a different project. So they're still in the loop. And so they're still getting this resource from us, even though we're not expending new resources on that particular thing, but we are doing it in other projects. And then we usually create a publication, actually a number of them, perhaps a video, like Access Advance, we created a video. Guess what? Female faculty members in STEM who have disabilities talking about their experiences, not only the challenges they faced, but also what advice they give to departments in STEM to make sure their programs are more inclusive of people like them. And then we create a printed publication, which is, in that case, we have one on how to make your STEM department more inclusive of faculty members with disabilities. At first, when we drafted it for women faculty with disabilities. And then we realized, as we were adding these things, we used our community of practice to give us ideas, by the way, and to continue to give suggested edits to us. So there's a lot of engagement with the community. What we realized is there wasn't one on the list that didn't apply to men faculty members as well who have disabilities. It's about disability. Even if you look at the intersectionality part of it, it's the disability that's a major barrier. We've even done some research in that area about interviewing women with disabilities who have been successful in STEM. Was it being female, a woman, that was the big issue, or was it the disability? And by far, disability is the one that weighs the heaviest on the scale as being a barrier for them. And so that wasn't a big surprise, but now we have that publication. We put it up on our website. Anybody can use it. There's a statement in there saying, this is a work in progress. If you have other suggestions you want that we should put on the list, or you have an edit that you suggest, please let us know. We don't get a lot of feedback, but we do get feedback. And sometimes somebody has a knee-jerk reaction because of the way we described a particular disability or something. We want to know that. Because if they did, then maybe somebody else will too. And so can we just, you know, word that a little differently? So we have a lot of things that are on the ongoing basis. We also have a knowledge base, and we have over 700 articles within our knowledge base. The articles are in three categories. Could be a promising practice at another institution or a project that would be described, or it could be a case study about a particular student or faculty member with a disability and how they were accommodated to be successful. Or it could just be a Q&A. How do blind people use computers? Or what does the ADA say about access to technology? In every project we have, we add to this knowledge base. We have over 700 articles in there at this point. But then if you go to a particular website, let's say Access Advance, we will have gone through all of those 700 and we will have tagged those that are relevant to that particular audience. And so if you go to the knowledge base on that website, you'll get a tailored knowledge base of only articles that are relevant to access goals.
Wow, that's a lot of articles. I did start to go through and see some of them. It was a lot, and I'm sure it must have taken a long time to curate all that information. One of the things I really liked what you said, it's the continuous reference back to community I know you said at the beginning that it's a community, but you can see that in your explanation just now. It's just how much having that ongoing feedback with people while you were creating the publication, giving them the opportunity to mm-hmm. give feedback, saying that this is a work in progress and continuing, which is so important because I feel like, you know, things are changing within the disability community all the time, like terminology changes, explanations change. So it's great that you had that opportunity to say, we're still changing. And as things change, we will update, because sometimes you don't see that. Sometimes resources are kind of out there and you're like, well, that's not relevant anymore. So it's nice that you're continuously working with the community to update information as it comes out, or just people's perceptions if something wasn't phrased right, even just fixing that.
It's not complicated. It's like, let me understand why you had this reaction to it. Let's think about that. Would this work? Would that work? You don't have to throw it away, but let's make it better.
Yeah, let's have a conversation about how to make improvements as opposed to just getting rid of it entirely or leaving it as is.
What's somewhat unique about our project too is elevating the roles and honoring the roles of different stakeholders. There'll be some disability-related programs that, well, you have to listen to students with disabilities. And we do. That's our primary group, right? But when we do something like Access Advance, we need to listen to the people without disabilities too. We need to know how people without disabilities in a department might feel about a faculty member who has a disability in that department. It is not necessarily a right or wrong thing, but some of that comes back from my experiences in growing up as a minority in computer science and mathematics, my original fields. There were very few women. And some people who were promoting women in various fields kind of left out the men. And my experience was always, we got to keep these men in here. We have to find some allies. They have all the power and all the money and all the positions. We should work with the majority as well. We should learn to. And some of us had to do a lot of making the coffee for the meetings and so forth to kind of get our foot in the door. But knowing why they were concerned about women in their fields or awkwardness, sometimes it was just awkwardness, like in computer science. I felt like a lot of the men in computer science are just like kind of awkward being around me because I was the only woman in the room. It's like, well, that's good for me to know. And maybe I can help them be less awkward. I don't know. But it's important to listen to parents. You know, what are the parents experiencing? Many parents of a student with a disability, they don't have personal experiences with a disability. When they were in K-12 school, they were, you know, supported by the people who did, special ed teacher and a counselor and whatever. But imagine the parent when their child graduates from high school, it's like they're kind of on their own, you know, and in a different environment where their student has to request an accommodation, for example. And how many students, when they go to college, are comfortable requesting something special from a faculty member or anybody else? And so sometimes these students will shy away from even telling anybody they have a disability. And so they don't get those accommodations that could help them be successful.
When I was a special ed teacher, that was something I thought about. So my kids were talking about going to college. I feel for the parents because you have a team with you. You're right. You have an entire team of teachers and child study team and, you know, LDTC behavior, whoever's on your team for the IEP. And then all of a sudden it's like, poof, and it's gone. I'm just happy that like a program like this exists that gives students an opportunity to see what college is, to help students feel empowered and like leaders, which might lead them into asking for the accommodations that they need, the faculty awareness of how to support mm-hmm. the students, which is huge. Like, you know, a faculty member being able to say like, oh yeah, that's something I can do. I know all about that. I'll do that already before I have a student like that in my class. Like,
exactly.
Good which for is, anybody.
Which is what is universal design, which is another thing that we promote with employers, but also academic institutions, is what are some things you might do, for example, in your online class to minimize the need for accommodations for students with disabilities? And there are some things that they could just do. For instance, if they have a little video introducing themselves to the class, like I do in an online class I teach, make sure that that video is captioned and it's accurately captioned. And if you look at the videos on YouTube, you realize a lot of them aren't accurately captioned. And that's because in most cases, people who create videos and post them online, which would be a lot of faculty, don't realize that YouTube has really good editing services there. All they have to do is get into the editing and they can put the punctuation in. They can correct the misspelled words rather than just sit back and complain about those darn old captions that are not very accurate. And I like to tell faculty members, you know, it's actually kind of a mean trick when you think about it, if that video is not captioned accurately. When for someone like a person who's deaf or even someone who's an English language learner and also needs to see punctuation and correctly spelled words, you take a course like chemistry, for example, you can imagine, you know, all the words that would be spelled incorrectly by a computer. That's just a simple example of how we're working with these stakeholder groups to create an accessible environment, whether it's in college or on the careers, but also then having the students prepared. It's like both are important and we work in both fields.
Yeah, there needs to be both sides. One of the things, speaking of the training of faculty, of employers, I saw in the 30-year breakdown that I think there were 1,000 training sessions that have been held since the program started. That's mostly, I assume, then for faculty members and for employers on accessibility, universal design. Are there any other areas of focus for the trainings that have been held?
Well, we have trained different audiences, like disabled student services professionals. I often will do training there, and it's to talk about universal design, that they're charged with providing accommodations. But it's good for them to also know about universal design and how they might want to promote some of these universal design practices with faculty on their campus. And so that would be a stakeholder group, this disability services group. And also by learning about universal design, they might, you know, change some of their correspondence with faculty. And so faculty know that they could integrate some of these things within their classes. And some disability services offices, through our efforts and others, of course, but have kind of incorporated universal design as part of what they're doing, that they want to spread the word about accessibility and get faculty members to buy into this idea that they could do some things that would actually make your course better, not just for a student with a disability, but for other students as well.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. I think that's something more people need to understand about the universal design process. Like they're thinking like, oh, it's just gonna be like one or two students. And it's like, no, those changes would benefit, I think, everybody involved. It really helps for them to understand that it wouldn't just be for like one or two students, it would be for like a large majority of students that mm-hmm. would benefit from these supports. Yeah. So I did want to ask, I know there are a lot and it's been, I'm sure, 30 years of successes, but what do you think have been the biggest successes that have come out of UIT so far?
We track a limited number of students if they agree to be part of our research. And there's a longitudinal study up on our website with a summary of data thus far. And we go back and interview students repeatedly over the years who, again, have agreed to be part of our study. And the thing that's most rewarding to me is the success we see in the students that are in our program. And the ones that we keep in touch with the most happen to be the DoIT Scholars because it's funded on an ongoing basis. But what I like to see is these students that transition to a higher level, like to a community college or two-year school or a four-year school, and then between those, and then get into employment and then share their experiences with the younger people. I just feel like there's just so much power when that happens. It's like, how can you ask for anything greater than that? And on our discussion list, we have a group mentoring model. I do not do one-on-one assignments because, first of all, it takes a lot of resources to do that. And I want to keep those communities going, even if we don't have those resources. But also, once you make a one-on-one match, are you going to do it by disability or by the topic they're interested in? And I believe in cross disability, cross other identities. I had some great mentors when I was young in computer science and mathematics. Not one of them was a woman. If I waited around to find a woman doing what I wanted to do, it wouldn't have happened. I like to see students with disabilities who are mentoring students who don't have disabilities. I really promote that. This last week, there was a student that posted on one of our lists. He kind of apologized. So I haven't posted a lot on this list, but I'm really trying to get into independent living. This is a young man who has cerebral palsy and he needs some personal care, but is pretty independent. And it happened on a weekend. He posted this message and is typical of me. I'm on the list and my other staff. We wait until someone answers. We really much prefer the other participants to answer it. In this particular case, it went like 2 days and I was kind of keeping my eye on it. And nobody responded. And I thought it was in part because he just made it so general. And so I responded. I said, you know, it's just a great question. And it comes up so often about how to be fully independent and so forth. And I know there are a lot of people that are interested in this topic. Can you be a little bit more specific about exactly what you're trying to do? What kind of living situation you'd like to have? But almost on cue, he did that, by the way. Two other students, they're in their 40s now. And I haven't seen them post for a while. And all of a sudden they're on it. It's like they knew mom was there that I posted this message and the message was as much to them as it was to this other student. It's like, come on, you know, we're a community here. And so I then could just back off. And then those two posted some very specific concrete suggestions. Some other kids chimed in, some were younger saying that they were trying to do that too. And that's the type of community we are. We're not like a social service where you have the student that has the need and us that have the service. It's a community. And as I mentioned before, it's much like a an extended family, you know, Uncle Joe that you only see on Christmas or Thanksgiving once a year, but he gives you some good advice about engineering or something. And you know, it's kind of like that. And everybody has a chance to participate. We do allow other mentors too. So anybody interested in participating, there is a mentor application on the website. We have kind of two sections when it comes to people participating. And that's one, people that are part of these stakeholder groups, kind of the institutions and people who are not themselves the person with a disability, and they can be mentors in the program, can apply. It's fairly easy to apply, and they don't have to have a disability. They just have to be interested in contributing to these young people and their success. But then they also, as I mentioned earlier, can join a community of practice. It tells you how to join them, and you can join. It probably was sponsored by some project that we have now or we had in the past. And then if you look at another link, it's Programs for Students. And there I mentioned the Do It Scholars program. It's now just for Washington State students. It used to be national when it was funded by the National Science Foundation for many years. And then they funded a project for us to institutionalize that practice. And so we had to find a way to keep it going. And I was successful in getting money from the state of Washington. And it was to keep that program going and to use that programmatic funding to write other grants. And that's one of the reasons we have some time we can spend in getting more grants to come into this project, is we can use that funding as well. And then there are other things that students can be involved in. I mentioned the Do It Pals earlier, but a lot of these projects like Access Computing do have a student community too. It's called the Access Computing Team. You'll see team on there when it's a student thing. And those students too, many of them have graduated from college now, and they're in employment situations and telling us all about what it's like to work at Microsoft or Google or someplace like that.
That's really incredible. I love the community aspect so much. I think that's so great to have. It's almost like an informal mentorship. It's just whoever's there and can answer is there to support. I'm sure people come back and say like, I've been through this. And somebody being able to see like themselves then in that future position, because they see someone like them in that role, I think that has to be really incredible. And then just to have the support and the backing of somebody in the community who's there to help you and guide you is really incredible.
We'll provide funding for some other activities as well. For instance, if a faculty member wants to have a panel in their classes, we often recommend that if they don't have any disability experiences, just themselves, and they're not sure how they're included in their classes, but invite a group of people, maybe four people with different types of disabilities. And they basically answer a few questions like, what was their experience in high school and college? And what accommodations do they get? And what advice do they give to faculty members? And if it's an engineering class, what advice do they give to designers to make products more accessible to them? And we pay the students, we'll give them a stipend for doing that. And we will even provide a facilitator if that's necessary, because we found many times the faculty members are kind of uncomfortable just even facilitating the panel. So we'll send someone. And if it's in person, like on our own campus, it's usually someone who has a disability as well, one of these older participants. And so they get paid as well, but they facilitate the panel. And we think that's a good way to get that word out. And so even faculty members across the country, even if they're not in our projects, we can fund a panel for them. We have some money that we've set aside where if they want to get a panel going. And they often say, well, I don't even know how to find these students. So, well, we'll find them. And what we tend to do is write a nice little invitation for anybody who wants to be on the panel. They usually get back to that faculty member, but they could get back to us. And the Disability Services Office, who will never give you the names of who is registered there, usually have a distribution list. And they're more than happy to let those students know of an opportunity. And then they're out of it. You know, they're not going to engage with us or them. And then we find these students. And then we have a facilitator. So we don't have to know the students ahead of time. And we just want to make sure they have different kinds of disabilities. So there are different perspectives that come out in the conversation.
Oh, that's really awesome. I didn't know that was happening right now. So that's really cool that that's another opportunity, again, to learn and to share. Well, I just want to thank you so much, Cheryl, for joining us today. And I'm really amazed by all of the programs and all of the resources with Do It. And I'm going to make sure that I share the link to some of those pages in the show notes so that everybody listening can check it out. And I just really want to thank you so much for sharing all with us today about everything.
Well, you're welcome. Again, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Assembly Inclusion Podcast. I hope the information in this episode taught you something new, gave you a new idea, or showcased a new perspective. If you liked the episode, feel free to leave us a review or comment. If you have a recommendation for an individual or an organization who would make a great guest, you can message us on Twitter or Instagram, or send us an email at assemblinginclusion@gmail.com. See you next time.